Now, if all the messages that have ever been spoken on the life of David could be put down into books, I'm sure that the world could not contain them. So I hope you're not expecting me to cover all of that ground in this time. But I would like to look at the life of David. Chad didn't have time to touch on some of the scenes in 1 Samuel, so we'll actually be covering some of 1 Samuel as well as it relates to David. And we're going to just go to, just read first in 1 Samuel chapter 15, and we'll read verse 26. And Samuel said to Saul, I will not, verse 27. And Samuel turned to go away. Saul seized the skirt of his robe, and it tore. And Samuel said to him, the Lord has torn the kingdom of Israel from you this day, and has given it to a neighbor of yours, who is better than you. And also the glory of Israel, and also the glory of Israel will not lie or have regret, for he is not a man that he should have regret. And then we'll skip down to chapter 16 and verse 1. The Lord said to Samuel, how long will you grieve over Saul, since I have rejected him from being king over Israel? Fill up your horn with oil and go. I will send you to Jesse the Bethlehemite, for I have provided for myself a king among his sons. Now this sort of foundational section is showing the transfer of the Lord's blessing as the anointed king of Israel from Saul to David. This is really kind of a foundational beginning of David's life as it relates to the kingdom, the kingship of Israel. One thing I wanted to point out first, just to draw your mind to, is that David really is a picture of Jesus Christ in the Old Testament. I just drew up some comparisons helped by C.H. McIntosh. Sorry, I forget his name. but, you know, both David and the Lord have many similarities. David was foretold by a prophet, Samuel. A few times, I think two, he was foretold to Saul that the Lord had chosen someone after his own heart, someone better than Saul, who would become the king of Israel. And as we know, that Jesus, the son of David, was foretold by prophets. David was unnoticed by men at the beginning. He wasn't even invited to the selection of Jesse's sons. He seems to have been serving in the house of Saul for a while before he rises to prominence. And also, Jesus, aside from the time when the teachers of the law would marvel at him, was pretty much unknown until he began his public ministry. David was anointed by Samuel with oil in the choosing of a king. And we can look at Jesus at the baptism of Galilee, the Spirit descending on his head as a dove, and the voice from heaven saying, this is my beloved Son, in him I am well pleased. And often in the Old Testament, when we see the oil, it would remind us of, it's a picture of the Holy Spirit, the working of the Holy Spirit. And so this would link it in our minds. He was also rejected by the fleshly man, by Israel. And the Lord Jesus was rejected by Israel and a fleshly present world. David was joined in that cave of Adullam by faithful men who were faithful to him in his rejection. And today we can look at the church who gathers to the Lord out of a world that has rejected him and is faithful to him. And then in the end, David receives a kingdom from the Lord. And in the end, we know that every knee will bow to the Lord Jesus when he receives the kingdom from his Father and reigns on this earth. So just before we got into all of the details, I wanted to draw this picture that we can see between similarities between David and the Lord Jesus. Now, just a quick outline. I adapted Chad's outline and expanded it a little bit, and I divided it into a few sections. First, we're going to look at David's rise to Saul's court. Then David, the rejected Messiah. Then we're going to look at David's deception. Thirdly, his rejection by Israel. And fourthly, his reign and conquest. And we'll be a little bit light on the last section but we'll see what time permits. So David's rise to Saul's court, and you might have noticed I said David, the rejected Messiah. And there's a point to that. I didn't just choose that to grab your attention, because the text actually should grab our attention all the way through. A key word in the books of Samuel is anointed, which is in the Hebrew, Mashiach, and it's where we get our word Messiah from. Messiah and Christ in Greek really means anointed. The anointed one, the one chosen, the one designated by God to fill a role. We'll see it over and over and over again, whether David's talking about Saul as the Lord's anointed, or David, the one himself who is anointed. So David is truly, and he's referred to in the text as the Messiah. It really just means anointed, but it should draw our minds to the final anointed one, the Lord Jesus Christ. And a key verse in this chapter 16 is, the Lord said to Samuel, "Do not look on his appearance or on the height of his stature, because I have rejected him. The Lord sees not as man sees. Man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart." And we saw last week that Saul was really a man after man's heart. He was taller than all the people. He looked good. They wanted a king to fight their battles, and the Lord really gave them exactly what they wanted. You know, if you were picking out a baseball team, Saul would be the first one you chose, and David probably the last. But Saul was a man after man's heart, and we saw where that got Israel, not in a good place. But when the Lord looks on the inside, on the heart, he picked a man after his own heart. So we'll go to the scene at the Valley of Elah, where David kills Goliath. And I won't belabor it too much, because I know we're all familiar with it. But, you know, the one thing that the children of Israel wanted from a king was a man to fight their battles, a man to stand at the front of them, to go in and out before them, to lead them out in the battle order and fight their battles. And we come to this section of 1 Samuel, and it's already fallen apart. The children of Israel are trembling before the Philistines, and Saul is camped in his command tent and not out there fighting Goliath. We could ask the question, why did it take a shepherd boy to fight Goliath when the king, who was a head and shoulders taller than the rest of Israel, was hiding in his tent? And there's an interesting comparison as well on the view of Israel and the army of Israel, whether it was by Goliath and the Philistines or by David. Goliath said, "Am I not a Philistine, and are you not the servants of Saul?" So in their estimation of the forces of Israel, they were the servants of Saul. They were the servants of the king. They had no conception or understanding. And really, at this point, Israel was following their king Saul and was very similar to what they're being described as, the servants of Saul. But David says, "I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied." David had a proper view of God's people. David had a proper view of the Lord's protection for his people. And this is really what enabled him to do what he did. He had a proper understanding and relationship with God, and he knew that God protecting his people would deliver the day through his hand or through anybody's hand that would trust in the Lord. And so we also see in this scene that Saul tries to give David his armor, and we could look at an application of this. David rejects it. He sets it aside. And we can ask, what happens in our Christian life when we try to do things in our own strength? You know, if I am trying to serve the Lord, do what I believe he's called me to do, but I'm trying to do it in my own strength, that will fail. And like David, we need to set that aside. We need to set aside our own, really, things that we would think would win the battle against Goliath, and trust in the Lord, trust in the things that he has given us and the role that he's given us to do. So we continue from this scene, and we see David's rise and Saul's decline. It's a very stark picture in the next section where David is rising. He's becoming more and more successful, more and more famous. He's going in and out before the people, And we see different reactions to him. Jonathan, immediately after this, he appreciates David. He gives him his most costly items that he would have, and they are bound together in friendship. But Saul begins to realize that David is probably the one that Samuel was talking about, the person that was better, the person that was going to really take over his throne and put him out of the kingship. And so Saul begins immediately to scheme against David. We can think, why did Saul act the way he did towards David? Why does Saul hate David? Because Saul, a selfish man, a man after Saul, man's heart, all he was interested in was his own position. All he was interested in was, the prominence he had over the Lord's people, the position that he had, and whether it was, in the Lord's will or against the Lord's will, he was going to stay there. And I think that's a dangerous position to be in. I can find myself in my own heart to have thoughts like this, that, this is what I want to do, and I don't want to read to look for guidance about it because I think I'm going to probably get a no. I'm just going to do it, and then we'll see what happens. That's acting very much like Saul. Whereas David is the one that is continually seeking after what the Lord wants. Even when he knew the will of God was for him to be king, he wouldn't put his hand out against the Lord's anointed and take that for himself. So, how do I, I can judge that those thoughts in myself. And then we also see that what someone thought of David made a difference in how they acted towards him. Saul hated David, so he schemed against him. Jonathan loved David, and his heart was bound to him. And we can see that same thing towards Christ. What I think of Christ, the amount that I value him, is going to show out in my actions, in my in what I do, in my attitude towards him. And it's also the same if you're not saved. If you're not saved and you don't appreciate the person of Christ, you're going to be an enemy of that of Christ. You're going to be like Saul and want to do your own way and really diverge and go away from him. And so we should look at our own heart. What do we think of Christ? What do we think of his person that will affect how we treat and react to him? So David's forced to flee, and we can just look at some principles from this section. God appreciates inward character. We can read in Psalm 118 and 8, it's better to trust in the Lord than to put confidence in man. And we can think about the failure of this fleshly king. The fleshly king doing things in his own strength couldn't deliver God's people. And whether that's in leadership today or in my own heart, I need to judge myself. Am I trying to do things in my own strength? And we already talked about the jealousy of Saul for his position. I need to judge that in myself as well. And then we can look at the enmity of Saul against David. David was really a shining example of a man after God's heart. And he was successful, and the Lord was blessing him. And Saul, rather than appreciating what that was doing for his own kingdom, was jealous and despised David because of that. So next we'll go to David, the rejected Messiah. So David is forced to flee from Saul. I have some maps, hopefully, to enlighten some of this travel, because I tend to read it, if I'm not paying attention to my Bible atlas, it can just become kind of numbing after a while. You're not really sure why he's going to where he's going. So Gibeah of Saul is where Saul's court was, and I'll be forgiven if some of these aren't exactly where they're supposed to be. I just grabbed this map from the internet, but I believe it's roughly correct. So David flees before Saul to Ramah, where Samuel is. He hides with Samuel for a while, and Saul sends messengers after him, and the Lord protects David miraculously. We're not going to read this section, but three times the messengers come and they prophesy before the Lord, not of their own volition. And then Saul himself comes and ends up prophesying before the Lord, stripping himself and laying down in the open, really in humiliation before the Lord, that he would try to touch the one that the Lord had anointed. So then Jonathan warns David sometime in this period. I'm not sure why Jonathan either didn't want to believe or didn't see that Saul, his father, was trying to kill David, despite the spears, etc. But David flees to Nob, where the priests are, and he receives help from the priests. And now, it's interesting, later Saul comes and kills all of the priests, and it's a gory, depressing story, but we actually see a fulfillment of prophecy against the house of Eli. In 1 Samuel 2 and 31, the prophet that comes to Eli says, "Behold, the days are coming when I will cut off your strength and the strength of your father's house, so that there will not be an old man in your house. Then in distress you will look with envious eye on the prosperity of that shall be bestowed on all of Israel, and there shall not be an old man in your house forever." And so through the actions of a fleshly evil man, Saul, and through a evil person, Doeg the Edomite, the will of the Lord was fulfilled. And we can wonder at this, that the Lord would use evil men for his purposes, even outside of their knowledge, but we could see even the soldiers who nailed the Lord to the cross, that God's purposes would be fulfilled, even using those who are acting in their own selfish will, acting against God. God is sovereign, and he was directing things through the events that happened in history towards a purpose and to fulfill his word. So this now obviously didn't happen while David was here. David next flees to Gath, and this is a little bit of a head-scratcher because, if you'll remember, Goliath was from Gath. This wasn't very long removed from that period. I'm not sure how many years he served before Saul, but they clearly remembered him because as soon as he got to Gath, they said, "Isn't this David of whom they sing that Saul has killed his thousands and David his tens of thousands?" And so David, probably in his despair, in his rush, you know, he has what he grabbed from the temple or from the tabernacle, but not much more. He just is trying to get out, and he goes to Gath. So he has to pretend to be mad, and he escapes the king. I'm not sure exactly how that worked. The Lord must have been with him because he was clearly a very capable commander. I'm not sure what they thought. So then David escapes to the cave of Adullam, where he gathers a band of men who gather around him. And we'll just look at that maybe in a little bit more detail. So this region, this is a cave from the region. I don't know if it's the real cave of Adullam or one similar. But David sets up a camp, I guess, in this cave, in a protected place away from Saul, towards the Philistines, kind of on the border between the land of the Philistines and the land of Israel. And these men, who are in debt, in distress, gather to the rejected David. And we can see a striking picture of the church in this. And I hadn't originally thought of this, but was brought out as I was reading about the Life and Times of David is the book by C.H. McIntosh. Tosh? Yes. Okay. Sorry. I'll get that right. So it's very similar to the church. We have gathered to Christ. We've gathered out of a world that hates him, a world that's an enemy of Christ, and we've gathered to the one who's the Lord's anointed, who is really rejected by this world, but we are accepted in him. We can see in ourselves before we were saved, if you're a Christian, that we had a debt of sin, discontented with our lot in life, that our path was going nowhere good. But when we were with Christ, we become one of his mighty men. We become really a person of valor, that we can do things for the Lord that we would have never been possible to do on our own. And really, appreciation of David led to separation from Saul's Israel. And our separation from the world really is not it's not something that we do voluntarily to try and become a better person. That is some sort of, you know, self-improvement program that the further away from the world I can get, the better I am as a Christian. It's this world has rejected my Lord. If I identify with him, I'm an enemy of this world. Now, obviously, for these men, it was starkly true. There was a stark contrast between them and Israel. If they went to Israel, they would be killed. They would be, if they were found with David by the world, they would be killed. And for us, obviously, it's not quite as black and white in our everyday life. But my attitude towards Christ will determine my attitude towards the world. If I appreciate him, if I am enjoying his presence and I'm with him, I can't be with the world. They're just incompatible. And so their identity with this Messiah, this anointed one who was rejected, separated them from Israel. So at this point, David sends his parents to Moab, likely to get them out of any retribution from Saul if he tried to use them as a tool to get David back. And he and his men deliver Keilah from the Philistines. It's a city in Israel that was being besieged by the Philistines. And actually, when he proposed it, his men said, "We're in danger every day from Saul, and you want to go attack the Philistines too." But David really was one of the key men that was a leader in the armies of Israel. And even if he was rejected from Saul's kingdom, even if he was on the run from Saul, he wouldn't leave the sheep of Israel unprotected. So he and his men deliver Keilah, and then they hear word that Saul's gotten wind of them, and they flee to the wilderness of Ziph, which is down in this area near the Dead Sea. So from Ziph to En Gedi, there's a large desert, kind of deserted area, and they flee to there where they think that they can really escape Saul and be out of the way. There's several oases in this area that provide protection and tablelands, and I think I have a picture. And then he escapes Saul multiple times. This is where he's on one side of the mountain and Saul's on the other. This is where the incidents in the cave and Saul sleeping happen. And continually through this time, actually, Saul is called back from chasing David in this area to deal with the Philistines. So just a note on the geography. This area here, circled here, is the land of the Philistines. That's a nice, big, plain, fertile area near the sea. And then in the mountains up here is where Israel was. And really, through failure to fully conquer the land, the Philistines have the good ground, and they're up in the mountains. But David and his men are down here. Saul has to keep traveling up to fight the Philistines and then come back to chase David in his spare time. So at En Gedi, despite being pursued, he doesn't leave Israel unprotected. And we can see his dependence on God in the time of distress. He wouldn't put out his hand against the Lord's anointed to take the kingship for himself. And we also see the story of Abigail and Nabal in this, and we can see that the person's appreciation of David really determined their actions towards them. So let's read. I don't have the chapter on here. I believe it's 25. And verse 10. So 1 Samuel 25 and 10. This is Nabal's answer to David's request for supplies. And Nabal answered David's servants and said, "Who is David? And who is the son of Jesse? There be many sons nowadays that break away from every man from his master. Shall I then take my bread and my water and my flesh that I have killed from my shears and give it unto men whom I know not whence they be?" And we can really see a sarcastic tone in Nabal's response to these men. It's interesting that they really didn't even mention that David was the son of Jesse. And Nabal's answer is kind of exposed here. He knows who David is, rightly. David was the key man leading Israel in and out of battle. How could Nabal not know who he is? But Nabal really despises David. And you can hear the stinging words of really sarcasm in his tone as he sends these men away that, you know, it's not convenient for him to share with them, even though they protected his flock. Maybe he's thinking, what will Saul do to me if they find that I helped David? He probably had heard about the priests at Nob at this point. But he really despises David. He reacts to him, showing scorn. And then in verse 21, David says, "Now David had said, 'Surely in vain have I guarded all that this fellow has in the wilderness, so that nothing was missed of all that belonged to him, and he has returned me evil for good. God do so to the enemies of David, and more also, if by morning I leave so much as one male of all who belong to him.'" And actually, the language he uses here is quite graphic for describing a male. If you look it up in the King James, he's enraged. He says, every man strap on your sword. We're going to totally wipe him out. And in his anger, despite not putting forth his hand to make himself king, it's almost as if he reaches the last straw, and his foot almost slips into committing this act, really of murder, of taking out all of Nabal's men. But the Lord sends to Abigail. And we see a completely different response and appreciation of David in her words. We'll look at verse 29. "If men rise up to pursue you and seek your life, the life of my Lord shall be bound in the bundle of the living in the care of the Lord your God. And the lives of your enemies he shall sling out as from the hollow of a sling. And when the Lord has done to my Lord according to all the good that he has spoken concerning you and has appointed you prince over Israel, my Lord shall have no cause of grief or pangs of conscience for having shed blood without cause, or for my Lord working salvation himself. And when the Lord has dealt well with my Lord, then remember your servant." You can see a totally different appreciation. She knew who David was. She knew what had been prophesied about him. She knew the place that he had, really as the king of Israel. And she appreciated him and reacted out of love and out of admiration and esteem for him based on what she knew about him. And so we can see that theme repeated in this story. And so looking at principles that we discussed, identity with the Messiah, with the rejected Messiah today, will result in separation from the world that opposes him, that rejected him. We can look at David's dependence on the Lord and really read through some of the Psalms that he probably wrote at this time that show his heart of dependence on the Lord, sometimes in his distress and in his grief and wondering what the Lord is going to do, if he's going to spare him. But he is depending on the Lord. We look at his humility and waiting on the Lord for elevation, and that the people's actions towards David were dependent on what they thought of him. So we continue to David's deception. At some point, he reaches what seems like a breaking point. He can't take it anymore, running from Saul after he's spared Saul's life twice, and Saul seems to be continuing to pursue him. David now flees once again to the king of Gath. He goes to Gath for protection again, and this time the king of Gath is sure that, you know, he's on the outs with Saul. He doesn't have to worry about him as a potential threat. He thinks this is probably a good chance to take David out of the picture from fighting against the Philistines. And we can read David's words in chapter 27. "Then David said in his heart, 'Now I will perish one day by the hand of Saul. There's nothing better for me that I should escape to the land of the Philistines. Then Saul will despair of seeking me any longer within the border of Israel, and I will escape out of his hand.'" So the king of Gath then settles him in Ziklag, which is down to the south, down towards Egypt. And he and his men raid against the enemies of Israel, even though they're telling the king of Gath that they're raiding really against Israel. So this is where David truly was raiding. And up here in these cities of Israel is where David said he was raiding. And so he was very careful for no messengers to get out. But we see that compromise in David, going to the king of Gath, living with the Philistines, compromise led to deception and to lies. And, you know, he couldn't let anybody escape from these towns, or else the king of Gath would know what was happening, know that his allegiance was really not as good as he thought it was. And then we find him in an even worse situation. In chapter 29 and verse 1, it says, "Now the Philistines had gathered all their forces at Aphek, and the Israelites were encamped by the springs that's in Jezreel. As the lords of the Philistines were passing on, hundreds by thousands, and David and his men were passing on the rear with Achish, the commanders of the Philistines said, 'What are these Hebrews doing here?' and I would like to ask the same question. What were the Hebrews doing there? How did David get to the point where he was called up to muster against the armies of Israel, against his own people, against the Lord's people? It was because of the initial compromise of running from En-Gedi to the world, we'll call it in picture, to the Philistines. That initial compromise led to one string of events after another that he couldn't stop. And I'd like to caution, now I don't want to fall down the slippery slope argument where, you know, if I end up on a slippery slope, there's nothing I can do to stop myself. But be very cautious when we look at this world's systems. When I'm in a trial and there's something in my life that I'm being tested on, whether it's by God or by the devil, we know that we don't enter into testing without a purpose. And even when it comes to the point of despair, if I take the easy way out, if I fail that testing, it can lead, depending on what it is, to one after another of a situation that I can't stop. The initial compromise was the start of a downward slope, and God thankfully spared David out of it, as we'll see, but not without pain. And so, I think I've already mentioned most of these things. But another thing we see is that really David, the man of God, wouldn't ever fit in with the Philistines. It was obvious. Here was David. Here was that commander, the champion of Israel, with the Philistines, and they knew that he was different. And really, no matter how far we go into the world, as a Christian, we'll never fit in. We'll never have that sense of belonging that we can find in the assembly, in the family of God, because we don't belong to the world. And so David finds this, but God rescues him out of this situation. So they come back to Ziklag after being rejected by the Philistines, and they find that their families are gone, their homes are burned, and all of their goods are taken. And David and his men pursue them. They get guidance from the Lord. Some of his men stop at this brook that may be obvious or not, too exhausted to continue. And they have a battle with the Amalekites. They're victorious. The Lord gives them a victory and really saves David out of this situation. But look at the pain and the anguish that he was put into because of his decision to go to the Philistines. His men actually almost stoned him. It said that they were conspiring to stone against him, or, you know, to stone him. But we also find it mentioned that David encouraged himself in the Lord. So he defeats the Amalekites. He returns to Ziklag, sends tribute. Obviously, they had been raiding other areas as well, because he comes back with this wealth of treasure and gives tribute to the cities of Judah that had supported him during his time of rejection. And so from that spoil that he's taken, he gives it to the cities of Judah. And from a material standpoint, probably wins some of their allegiance to set him up as the king of Judah that we find in the next section. And so we've already discussed this, but it's a very precious moment when it says, David encouraged himself in the Lord. Up until that point, all the way from his escape from Saul the last time until he comes to really the burning ruins of Ziklag, we don't have the Lord mentioned. He's all acting in his own strength. But the Lord brings him back. He brings him back to a point where David could encourage himself in the Lord and rely on him for salvation. So then we come to David's rejection. We've already looked at the rejected Messiah, but this is David's rejection by Israel. So David is now crowned by Judah in Hebron. So Saul dies in the last chapter of 1 Samuel, and his son Jonathan as well. And David hears of it and puts the messenger to death because he claimed to have killed Saul. Whether he did that or not, it's not exactly clear. But David is brought by Judah and crowned over Judah in Hebron. Hebron's this city down here. It's one of the cities of refuge. I think it was in the hill country. It was, I believe, a fortified city. And David's crowned there. And then Abner takes Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, and crowns him in Mahanaim. And there begins a two-year civil war between the house of David and the house of Saul, between Judah and Israel. Israel rejects him as their king, and Judah crowns him. And the war begins with a bloody battle at Gibeah. Gibeah is kind of right up here. This is roughly the border. This is the Philistines between Israel and Judah at that point. And many of the men of Israel are struck down by the men of Judah, and then they're stopped by the cry of Abner, "How long will you continue killing your brothers?" Basically. And then at this point, while David's reigning in Hebron, he somehow acquires five wives, that it just mentions that he has sons while he's reigning in Hebron. Now, a important maybe historical context to that, or just discussion point, is that at the time, an important part of diplomacy, of sealing treaties and pacts, was to marry your daughter of the king to the king or prince or a member of the royal family of the country that you were having a treaty with. So David reigning in Hebron, this is kind of pointing to maybe some starting of international ties. We know at least some of them are from different countries outside of Israel, or at least different city-states that would then, make treaties with him through these wives. Just sort of by the way, mentioning point. And then, looking at Solomon, and the great trade network that he had at his time was probably part of the reason for his thousands of wives that we kind of marvel at this, modern culture. Not to say that that was a good culture. Obviously, we see that it led him astray. So after 2 years of war, Abner is really sick of the leadership of Ishbosheth. There's a quarrel over one of Saul's concubines, and Abner says, "I'm going to come make peace with David to crown him over Israel." He kind of gathers a consensus of the people of Israel and comes down to make peace. And then he's assassinated by Joab, right at that critical moment. And, maybe growing up and reading the story and hearing the picture in the gospel of Abner dying as a fool dies, I didn't realize the pivotal point that this was in the narrative of 2 Samuel. So after a two-year civil war between Israel and Judah, when a messenger of peace is coming, he's assassinated by the general of David's army. And you might wonder at this point, what's going to happen? As you're living through this, is this war going to continue forever until they, each side annihilates each other because of this hostile act? But we read in 2 Samuel 3 and verse 35, "But David swore, saying, 'God do so to me and more also, if I taste bread or anything else till the sun goes down.' And all the people took notice of it, and it pleased them, as everything that the king did pleased all the people. So all the people and all Israel understood that day that it had not been the king's will to put to death Abner, the son of Ner." And it's important to remember at this point that David was not the king of all Israel when this happened. So all of Israel knows that it wasn't David's plan. It wasn't part of David's will to put Abner to death. And so David's character, David's righteous character before God as he's reigning here, is made evident even in the plans of wicked men. So Joab assassinates him, but through David's character, he's preserved from further war. And so then at the same time, soon after, when they hear Ishbosheth is assassinated at Mahanaim. So his men, the two of his generals, have enough of him as well, and they put him to death. And then David also puts them to death. We can read... Actually, we're not going to read for the sake of time. So David puts them to death. They make peace. Now Israel and Judah united for the first time since they came over with Joshua. During the time of the judges, we see a lot of war between different tribes in Israel. And finally, they're united under a king, under David, and he's crowned over Israel at Hebron. So then he comes up with all of the armies of the combined Israel now and takes Jerusalem. During the whole time frame of the conquest of the land, you'll remember that Joshua and the armies actually came across this ford in the Jordan and went up to Jericho, which is kind of under the label here, and conquered all through the land. But this whole time, the city of Jerusalem, or Jebus at that point, was a stronghold up in the mountains that couldn't be taken. But now, united under David, they come up and I think go up a aqueduct or something like that and take Jerusalem, and then David reigns in Jerusalem. So I hope the maps were helpful in understanding kind of the geography of what David was doing. I'm not going to continue with them for his conquest, just for sake of time and clarity. But David is finally, through the workings of God in his life, brought to the point where he's crowned, really reigning as king in Jerusalem, the city of David, where he now continues his reign from. So we can look at principles from this section that even despite being anointed king over Judah, David really didn't seek to achieve his own advancement through what we'll call underhanded means. You know, David realizes that the Lord cares just about as much about means as the way something is done as what's actually the result of that. And we'll see that throughout the Bible. People who take things into their own hands, and really that's the initial failing of Saul, forcing the offerings when he was impatient to wait for Samuel to come, you know, taking things into our own hands, doing things out of our own scheming and not in the correct way, will never be blessed by God. God can obviously work things out through the actions that are not in his will because he's sovereign, but that's never God's intention for us. And so David's upright character really preserves him from association with Joab and his scheme. And then when David's relying on the Lord, really the Lord resolved the situation himself. Who could have planned that two of Ishbosheth's generals would conspire against him and kill him? Clearly it wasn't David's plan, but the Lord brings him into the kingship when David's relying on him. So then we come to really the final chapter of this message. We are looking at David really up to the point right before the story of Bathsheba. And so this is now when David is reigning in Jerusalem and his conquests over the land. And the first thing he does when he's installed in Jerusalem is to bring up the ark. So David wants the presence of the Lord with him. He brings up the ark, but he does it in the wrong way. And we see again, doing things in the wrong way, even if we have, the intention in mind to accomplish things for God, is never successful. So the Philistines, when they sent the ark back, they had no clue what the Lord's word was concerning the ark. They just knew they wanted to get it out. They wanted to make sure it wasn't some happenstance that that all these bad things were happening. And so they put it on a cart with the oxen. They let it go, and it gets to Israel by itself through the Lord's working. Now, when David goes to bring up the ark, I'm not sure whose idea it was. It doesn't say, but the ark was on a cart again. When the law of Moses clearly says that men had to carry it on their shoulders with the poles that were part of the ark. And so the oxen stumble that, you know, all through the wilderness, over the Jordan, through the Red Sea, the men carrying the ark, it never records them stumbling. But these oxen that are carrying it, they stumble. And Uzzah puts his hand out to steady the ark and is struck down. And so again, we're reinforced that the methods are just as important to God as results. And so then David now, a while later, brings the ark to Jerusalem the correct way. And there's a great celebration. He's slaughtering animals before it and dancing and rejoicing with the people of God. And we see the scene where Michal, his wife, the daughter of Saul, despises him when she sees him out there appreciating the things of God. And so we see here a principle that the house of Saul, this fleshly house, can't appreciate the things of God. They see the things of God as really something almost embarrassing. And we can look at our own life. You know, if I'm a Christian, I value the things of God. You know, my activities in the assembly are really an outflowing of my value of the person of Christ. But if I'm not a Christian, if I'm not saved, and, you know, I just try to kind of look the part, I'm with the people of God, really in the end, I will never value the things of God. If I'm outside of Christ, I'm outside of all that enjoyment of God, enjoyment of the things that he's done for his people. And so we see that principle here. And so it's a warning. Even though she was with David in his reign in Jerusalem, she still despised the things of God and despised those who enjoyed the things of God. And then we come to the Davidic covenant. we'll turn to, let's see. Actually, I have 5 minutes, so we're not going to turn. But David, you know, he's surrounded in his house that Hiram had sent some lumber and carpenters and built David this palace. And the Lord wants to build a house, David wants to build a house for the Lord. And I'm sure there's many ministry messages that have looked at whether this was a right request or not, but the Lord honors David's intentions. The Lord knows that David wants to really honor the Lord for bringing him into this position of the kingship. And so the Lord makes a single-sided covenant with David. This is important. It's much different than the covenant of Moses with the people of Israel, where he said, you know, if you keep these commandments, you'll be blessed, but if you break these commandments, you'll be cursed. He says, I will build you a house. There's no mention of David in this. Because you wanted to do this for me, I will build you a house. You'll never lack a man to sit on the throne. And it's really a prophecy in that moment, a covenant to the line of David continuing to Christ. And that line of David is unaffected by his sin with Bathsheba. David doesn't let down his side of the covenant because there is no side for him. God has made a one-sided covenant with David. And in salvation, in cleansing from sin and being brought into the family of God, brought into the person of Christ, God has made a one-sided covenant with us. No matter what we do, once saved, once a member, a child of God, once our sins are forgiven, there's nothing for us to do to continue to stay in that blessing. Now, that's not to say that we won't be righteous people because we're saved. It's because we're saved, because we've been cleansed, because we've been given new life that we'll act like that. But nothing we can do can take us out, can be snatched out of the hand of God in that one-sided covenant of salvation. So then we come also, there's some, we'll cover his conquests really at the end, kind of as a passing note. But we come to this scene of David and Mephibosheth. So David, in his reign, he's now set up, and he wants to fulfill his promise to Jonathan. We read in 1 Samuel 20, in verse 42, Jonathan said to David, "Go in peace, because we have sworn both of us in the name of the Lord, saying, 'The Lord shall be between me and you, and between my and your offspring forever.'" We can read in 2 Samuel chapter 9, and verse 1, and David said, "Is there still anyone left of the house of Saul that I may show him kindness for Jonathan's sake?" And then further down the chapter, David says to him, "Do not fear, for I will show you kindness for the sake of your father Jonathan, and I will restore to you all the land of Saul your father, and you shall eat at my table always." In verse 13 we read, "So Mephibosheth lived in Jerusalem, for he always ate at the king's table, Now he was lame in both his feet. And so we see this great picture that's often used in the gospel of bringing someone that was an enemy of David into the house of God, into the house of David, and making him really as one of the king's sons, restoring his possessions, blessing him, eating at the king's table, enjoying fellowship. And it's a picture really of us also being brought into the kingdom of Christ. So when Christ receives the kingdom from his Father, really will be also brought into that kingdom because of his sacrifice and his promise to us. And so I may have mixed those metaphors a little bit, but we can untangle them afterwards perhaps. Sorry. So then we come to, and it's kind of interspersed here, probably deserves a ministry message of itself, but David's victories over the people of Israel, the people surrounding Israel. So we see victories over the Philistines. As soon as he's crowned in Jerusalem, they come to attack him, and he defeats them. We see him defeating Moab. we see a northern coalition of, I believe, Amorites and Syrians. The Amorites had been defeated by Joshua, but here they are again. The Syrians are their neighbors to the north, where modern-day Syria is. They join together to fight him. And I think, you know, looking at Psalm chapter 2, or the second Psalm, you can really almost get a picture of this when it says that the kings of the earth have conspired together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let us burst their bonds asunder. And maybe that's the second coalition, but you can really get a imagery into David's attitude towards them, that the Lord in heaven would laugh against them and put them to scorn and break them with a rod of iron. So David is successful in all of these conquests. But we might ask, why are all of these nations so powerful? Why did they have to be defeated? And it was really through failure of Israel to finish what Joshua had started. So Joshua led the people of Israel through the land of Canaan, defeating their enemies. They had God fighting for them. But we get to the section where it says, but there was still this part, but there were still these people here, but there were these. And all of these almost defeated people come back and are a plague to Israel and really drive Israel to a point where they were hiding in the mountains and up in a not a fertile area, and really a weak nation because they had failed to stop them when they were almost defeated. And we can look in our own life and see principles from this. When I've almost defeated sin, it's not good enough. And obviously in this life, we'll always be really affected by our flesh, affected by sin. But if there's something in my life that's, I've just kind of left in the corner. I haven't completely gotten rid of it. It will start to grow and grow and grow until it's really taking over and I'm weak and powerless against it. And so let's let that be a warning to us to what we how we deal with sin and with enemies in our life. Not talking about personal enemies, obviously. And so in conclusion, David was a man after God's own heart. He had faith and dependence on God. Even though he failed, even though we see different points in his failure, he's brought back to God. He repents. Unlike Saul, who makes excuses, David repents. He encourages himself in the Lord. He comes back to him. And God really uses his failures for blessing and to rescue him. But again, I'll mention, his failures were not without pain. It ended up causing pain to him, causing pain to his men. So let's be careful as we look at compromise in our life. But David was reliant on God to elevate him. And in the end, David's really a picture of Jesus, the true anointed one, the true Messiah, Christ. Those are all the same word. The king rejected in this world. We now gather around him because we love him. And then someday he's going to receive the kingdom from God, and every knee will bow and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord. And so I appreciated these things about David, and I hope you can as well. And Obviously, these slides will be available at some point for download if you want to take a closer look at the maps or some of my random notes in them. So let's close in prayer and thank the Lord for really the person of Christ that we've seen in this section.